Hello, my name is Willem Larson, and you're listening to the podcast for the College of Mythic Cartography for May 6th, 2008. In this episode, I'm going to bring several lines of thinking together, so several different subjects that I've touched on in other podcasts. It's very difficult for me to think of these, any one of these subjects as its own thing, because they're all so interwoven anyway. They're this complete whole, and that stretches from clarity and peacemaking to language issues with e-primitive, e-prime, and all those kinds of things. One of the things I didn't mention in the Clarity and Peacemaking podcast that I'd like to talk about in this one is the grave of right and wrong. A while back, a couple years back, I realized that one of the fundamental, I guess you could call it corruption, or fundamental issue, fundamental bug in my thinking involved this problem of either of wanting to be right and avoiding being wrong and being very concerned about whether other folks were right or wrong. And I, even now, I can remember being, 12, 13, 14, and have very vividly, I remember having arguments with people where suddenly I realized their facts, their information anyway, suddenly it sounded more convincing than mine. But I wasn't willing to be honest about that. I wasn't willing to go, oh, you have an interesting point there. I'll have to think about that. No, it made me cling even more desperately to the tatters of my argument. And it made me realize in these later years, what was I wanting in the first place? What was I grasping for? And I think I understand it now. I was grasping for the feeling of ecstasy of being right. That mastery of information, the prestige, and it's a cheap thrill. It's not a nourishing experience to be right, in my opinion. When I think of the times when I've been right and somebody else has been wrong, it's had such a feeling of winner and loser that my achievement has had some amount of loss in it. The relationship becomes damaged, or, who wants to be wrong, really, and who likes a person who's right all the time, either, You'd think if right was such a good thing, those people who are right all the time, we'd be like, yay, that's awesome. But no, it's actually rather maddening, for me, anyway, because in the end, if all we are is struggling over right and wrong, it's really more of an abstraction. And what is right and wrong in the universe? I believe that the only things that are correct is the imitation of what another human being has done. Does a spider make a web correctly? Does the sun rise correctly? Do waves crash on the shore correctly? No, it's correctly, and correctness and right and wrong are things human beings do, and with a special exemption that human beings have, that their needs and their feelings are specially exempt from natural law to be judged in all these ways. And I'd submit to you that right and wrong are just very poor measures for what is actually satisfying. That according to any particular moral system, something may be right, but it may not be something that affirms life, that creates more life. In fact, it may do quite the opposite within, any particular moral system. A right thing may be actually a very damaging thing. And, our culture is full of such cases, and I can't imagine that I need to provide examples. We're all familiar with those experiences where we know we're standing in what the culture considers a wrong place, but what we're doing is so life-affirming that it just doesn't make any sense. So the grave of right and wrong for me is a kind of a consciousness of burying those concepts as really being limited in their usefulness, of providing very poor results for the aims of creating a better and better life for me, my children, my family, the planet, you know, my land. And sometimes this has meant actual physical burying. When I shared this with a friend of mine, Tony, he actually would have tracking apprentices of his bury their tape measures, you know, to get away from that correctness of the measure, to bury, you know, their journals or bury the things that actually were hanging them up and making them feel less free and less in the depth of the relationship that they were exploring through tracking, that these tools were getting in the way and creating abstractions that were clouding actually observing the animal and observing the other, you know. So the grave of right and wrong is all about changing how you measure the world, changing how you course correct your behavior, changing how you evaluate all the feedback you're getting from the world. I think definitely as a human being, we need to evaluate somehow what we're experiencing and what we're learning. And something that's replacing a moral code or an ethical code, at least for an average member of our culture, you'd better be able to make a pretty darn good case for throwing away morals and ethics and replacing them with a different measure. And at least for me, I strongly associate right and wrong with moral codes, right? Moral measures. So the implication is clear, you know, if there's no right and wrong, well, good and evil have started to look pretty shaky. So if there's no good and evil, what do we do? Is that absolute chaos? Well, in this, we have our the fact that as human beings, we have inner compasses that despite all the repression and the domestication, they're encouraging us towards life-affirming ends. As living beings, we want to live good lives. You know, there may be obstacles that we create for ourselves even, but on some level, our bodies are tuned to live good lives, to quench our thirst when we need our thirst quenched, to have companionship when we need companionship, right? As animals, we're perfectly tuned to be sensitive to our needs. They're in there, and they're always talking to us. So really what our guidance is, if as Jean Liedloff, as I've mentioned before in her Continuum Concept book, if as she claims that children are innately social beings, right? They innately want to get along. They want to experience loving relationships on both ends, right? That they aren't purveyors of chaos, that they are explorers of human realms, looking for boundaries. And, you know, looking for the bounded space within which to be safe, the relationships that are worth having. Okay, well, it's still there. We've all been children. If that's true as children, then it's still true as animal beings. So we can rely on that sense that innately we need loving relationships. Innately, humans are tribal family beings. Innately, beauty touches our hearts. Innately, we want to have children, you know. Nobody has to tell us about these things. Our body tells us about these things. So, and this goes back to the surplus thing too. The more you reinvest in yourself in terms of healing, reinvesting that 90% back into yourself and basically, you know, tithing the 10% back to your community. It's not a novel concept. There's plenty of traditions which have this idea. But so you, once you've nourished yourself enough with this 90, and hopefully that's happened in a healthy childhood, but maybe it hasn't. Maybe after you have to do your work later on in life and really refocus on reinvesting that 90. But once you've done that, you'll blossom as a social being, right? Now, sometimes I, not to try and read anybody's mind, but I heard feedback about this of, oh my God, but people would become sociopaths and without a moral code to guide us and without shoulds and oughts, we'd steal and we'd do whatever. And if it's just listening to your body, then whatever, you know, the lusts and whims and all that. And it's like, well, but that's not actually listening to the wholeness of our humanity. I mean, of course, we've always got the tension of two different needs within us, right? And often, like, passions of the moment fight with long-term needs, sure. And socially, our uncle, who doesn't get along with our brother, but gets along with us, may want something from us that we know our brother wouldn't approve of, right? And then so what to do? Oh, you know, you have to choose. But I mean, in all of this, you're making the best of it. There's no right choice. There's only consequences of your choice. You know, to choose this thing, choose for your uncle means that then your relationship with your brother has suffered. What are you going to do? You know, in our culture, there would be punishment involved. You know, there would be condemnation, but no, what's really happened is a loss of trust. Whatever we choose, you know, we face these decisions all the time. As a people who rewild in the city, we're always facing one devil's bargain after another. You know, maybe we do work that requires that we get into a car in order to accomplish it. And yet we know that being in a car conditions us to the car lifestyle. And that's really troubling. You know, and that's not something we want. And we notice we get in like worse shape and get more road rage and all that. But it's consequences. You know, what life do we want? It's not right or wrong to be in a car. It's the life we want to create for ourselves. And if to do the life-affirming thing that's most worthwhile, that goes most in the direction of where we want to go, means driving a car, well, so be it, you know, so be it. It's these exact kinds of issues that have informed our humanity from the beginning, in my belief. If you think about it, from the beginning, it has troubled humans. It has troubled human beings that we kill to live, that we kill to eat. It's a troubling thought that our beautiful neighbors, that our absolute noble, wise, powerful, amazing family in the community of life that prospers, the wolves and the trees and the wind and the waters and the deer, they do so well without any tools, just living their lives wild on the land. And here we are as human beings that we have to kill them too for our shelter, for our clothes, for our food. And we need them so much more than they need us. How do we make this right? Right? What do we do about this relationship? Well, the solution is as old as the hills, right? The solution is do what you need to do and then attend to the damage you've done to the relationship, right? So express your thanksgiving after you've killed the animal, after you've taken the water from the river, after you've harvested the plant. You know, that's the only thing that makes it not murder and not just pure consumption and ignorant destruction is the attending to the relationship. How this has impacted me most in my life is I used to get very panicky when I wouldn't be able to, I didn't feel like I could satisfy someone, or maybe I'd, felt I'd done them wrong, or we got into an argument and I thought, oh my God, we got into an argument, you know, it's over, it's totally done, you know, and then I'm walking on eggshells but the funny thing is, even though every time it felt like the end of the world, it always turned out okay, because right and wrong were always besides the point. They were always besides the point. That people can hold grudges for decades, but often that's because the right and wrong has gotten in the way. That really, if I could have a safe argument with somebody, if I could go, we're going to feel what we're going to feel, and it's neither right or wrong, it's us exploring our relationship, then all of a sudden all kinds of possibilities open up. All kinds of fears get buried along with those concepts of right and wrong. And, you know, fear is a valuable human emotion, but let's save it for the important things rather than, you know, the relationships that should be loving and reliable and stable, you know, and nourishing us. Not full of unsatisfying drama. Well, let's fill it with satisfying drama. And let's learn what the difference is between those two things. So that brings us back to, how do we measure the results of what we do? You know, when we've killed that animal, when we've driven that car, how do we measure it? Well, is it making our life better? Knowing the constraints we have, is it creating a more abundant landscape and, you know, human habitat in both the land and the family and your friendships? And if it is, well, great. We want to do more of that. Whatever word you want to apply to that, that's what we want more of. I call those things useful. And I like to think of, and that's why I call this way of thinking the what works philosophy. You know, it's what we can use to create better lives. It's useful. It works. You know, the boat floats, right? And if the boat didn't float, it'd sink. So it's a very simple way of measuring things. And you do have to get in tune with your needs as a human being, as a human animal, and your feelings that are flagging those needs all the time, constantly. Just like when you're standing still, you'll notice you're doing little micro adjustments to stay on balance. Well, we do that also with our needs and our feelings. So you tune into those. This then brings me to the whole issues of judgment that came out that I touched on in the Clarity and Peacemaking podcast, where, you know, right and wrong are, well, they're judgments, of course. So we're embedded in a culture of judgment, as we're all very aware of. Many of us are still trying to get over that pursuit of the gold star that schooling addicted us to. Achievements that are empty of content, but really addictive, and they have a kind of ecstatic quality of them that lasts for a little bit and makes us want more and more. But when we let go of those judgments, we realize that we also don't have to offer advice anymore, because who's an expert on any one person's needs and feelings? Well, that person has the most on-the-ground experience that you will ever encounter for their own needs and feelings. And this is manages to slay the monster of advice. As a culture, we're also addicted to advice because advice follows from judgment, right? But just like when you do dream interviews with people and you to help them interpret their dreams, you discover that you end up the first mistake is to project your own issues onto the person and to have the solution, the interpretation of their dream in your own hand and try and force feed it to them. Well, so as with us, we give advice for other people, advice that is perfect if we took it ourselves. I mean, isn't that obvious? What do we know best? Our own problems. But unfortunately, being a culture of the book and of one size fits all solutions, we think we have to have other people affirm our own ideas by taking them up and applying them to their own lives. So there's no, it's impossible to be an expert on somebody else's situation. And that's why instead of giving advice, you tell a story. And if there's something in it for somebody else, great. And if there's nothing, great. You haven't wasted any breath because it's great to tell your own stories. I certainly enjoy it. And it's good to be heard. And everybody can like listen to a story and have, food for thought. But it's when stories are twisted and turned into advice. You should do this because this will happen to you. Why do you have to learn it the hard way? Well, people have to create their own stories to pass on. So, on my on a forum on the internet, rewild.info, that some of you may go to. That's rewild.info. I help moderate there, and I came up with a system, a structure for. It's not quite conflict resolution, but it addresses when things get kind of knotted up and communication doesn't happen. And the structure is tell your story, ask a question, or go somewhere else. And those are your options. And I've really discovered that this works great in my own life, and I've started to catch myself. At first, I just thought it was good for the internet because the internet is fraught with miscommunication. But then the more and more, every time I notice myself giving advice and I'd see the person either start resisting or take it, and then it was not appropriate advice. Who wants to be at fault for that, you know? Then I realized, like, one of my favorite authors, J.R.R. Tolkien, said about The Lord of the Rings that he found books that were had like purposeful messages that were meant to be a metaphor for a situation or a political reality. He really found them abhorrent. And he wrote The Lord of the Rings as an expression of what brought him joy and the issues that he cared about that occurred between people and the land and what in his life gave him passion, but none of it was political commentary, right? And I was really taken with that about his passion in speaking about such a thing. And I realized, wow, that must be why Lord of the Rings has such a strong impact on so many different kinds of people, because it is absolutely a story, not a it's a fictional story, But it's definitely, it's still a powerful story that comes out of a man's life who was orphaned and served in World War One and lost most of his best friends and saw his small town shabbily turned into a smoky suburb over those years of his youth. He experienced all these things, and in his fervor to not tell people how to live, to wag his finger at people, but just to tell a story worth telling, it made his experiences more real and more full of lessons, broadly applicable lessons that a person could discover for themselves, and maybe he didn't even know were in there, than anything. And that's the power of stories. And I've run into a lot of people, people who don't have strong cultural traditions of eldering, or their version of eldering in their culture is that of judgment, right? I've noticed that these people tend to almost have a kind of a busybody energy, and to have advice for unsolicited advice for all kinds of folks who are younger than them. And although many of these people in my life I love, I really, the part I like least about them is the advice they give. And it's kind of shocking, really, to witness somebody giving away what, in one sense, is the transformed treasure of their lifetimes, and just throwing it away to people who aren't appreciating it. And it's really taught me a lesson that, you know, I can tell stories all I want, and that's an immensely satisfying thing. And every time I give advice, I lose my audience, and I just start throwing my treasure in the dust. I've turned it into lead, you know? I've turned the gold of my life into lead and thrown it in the dust. When keep it gold, keep it in story, you know, don't turn it into advice. And though that may be my advice to you, I hope you'll take it as my personal story. That's certainly how I interpret my own life and the experiences of my own life. And this also shows how difficult it is to talk about these issues and pull apart the really niggling things that they, you know, our language and our culture want you. They constantly pressure you to express yourself in these ways of advisory ways and judgmental ways. And, you know, even here, as I'm trying to talk about methods I use for my own life, I'm handing out advice over it. It's troubling. It's troubling, and it's something I still wrestle with. But it's exciting. It's exciting whenever I can just relax and just tell the story. The other half of that, of course, is the asking a question, right? And that's amazing. You know, when somebody has a story to tell, but maybe they don't know it, and to let that story blossom out of them, but I'll give that story room by asking them a question. And this is a gift we do for each other. We ask each other about our lives, and it feels so good to hear that interest. And it also means that we, by asking a question, we don't make assumptions, you know. We don't go, oh God, this is another one of those guys who's really means this. We go, so by what you're saying, do you mean this particular thing? And then we get to hear whether that rant we were about to go into was actually applicable at all. So the asking a question is the mirror image of telling a story. It's like another way to not waste your the energy of your body, the breath in your lungs, and the care, the relationship that hopefully you value. And I would ask you to observe when you find yourself getting into situations where you're hanging on to right and wrong, that you're not interested in asking a question or telling your story. Look at the relationship you're fighting over. And maybe ask whether, is this relationship even worth this? If I'm willing to damage it to this extent by battling over things in this way, trying to be right and have the other person be wrong, why don't I go spend some time with people I care about and ask them about their stories or tell my own? But, that's a choice we make, where to put our energy. And also, there might be times when it's appropriate to have a culture of debate and a culture of argument. I don't know. And that's why the third part of that, tell a story, ask a question, or go somewhere else to meet the need that you're struggling to have met, whether it's just that you want to condemn somebody, or you want to make assumptions about their story, or you want to tell them who they are. I don't know this universe well enough to know that that's never a useful thing to do. I found it less and less useful in my own life, but that's the little back door that you save. That you choose that consciously in this way of looking at the world. You, every time you do that, it's a choice. And you walk into it with eyes open. And that's the beautiful thing about this, is you can begin to give water and food and shelter to the relationships. You can nourish them, the ones that you value, in this way, because you can observe the results of it. And that's what I encourage you to do. And all this sort of pseudo advice I've given, really all I'm doing is offering up something to try and play with. And the only way to know whether this is useful in your life is to observe the results. And how you measure those results is up to you. But if you measure them on a scale of, is this creating more life, more joy? Is it making my family stronger, my relationship with the land stronger? If you use those measures, I think you will notice, as I have, that these are really useful tools. So, in a sense, one can encompass all of this in the idea that wisdom comes in story. It's as simple as that. That a wisdom doesn't come in advice, and it never has. Wisdom doesn't come in commandments, and it never has. Wisdom comes in stories that we tell about our lives and the lives of people we care about and people who have lived. And I think that's a very powerful thing. And that's what makes us human. So thanks for listening. This has been the podcast of the College of Mythic Cartography for May 6, 2008.